Professor, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
Now, let's note you spoke today at the National Constitution Center. Nowhere in the Constitution, though, does it mention this presidential primary process.
No, and in fact, political parties aren't in the Constitution either. Our political process evolved a lot through the 19th century as more people got the vote, as the parties emerged to represent different interests. By the early 20th century, there was a real sense that the party bosses had too strong a stranglehold over the nominations. And that's where we first began to see presidential primaries as a way of giving the power back to the people.
And the states have a lot of latitude in structuring the primaries. Are they closed? Are they open? Is it winner take all? Apportionment?
That's exactly right. I mean, there is no single kind of national blueprint whether the parties have to do it like each other. You know, the Democrats can conduct theirs differently from the Republicans. So we have this very messy system where different regional preferences, different traditions prevail in each state.
Let's move on to the Republic of Spin. I presume you're not referring to 33 and a third.
No. You know, spin is a term that came into the vogue really in the 80s for kind of the whole mess of messaging and image making that now has come to define modern politics. And so this book is a history of the White House spin machine, both on the campaign trail and from the Oval Office, and how candidates and presidents have learned to develop and then to use new machinery to shape their messages, to shape their images, for the reason we were talking about before, because political power has come increasingly to reside with the people.
And indeed, to communicate, you have to broadcast that message. Let's note, prior to being a historian, you were a full-time journalist. To what extent is the media complicit in this action?
Well, the media, journalists have always been a central part of the spin machine. From the president's point of view, you know, the journalist's job is simply to tell the public what he, the president, or the candidate is saying. From the journalist's point of view, their job is to not be a mere conveyor belt for official messages, but to tell the people what to really think, to analyze it, to contextualize it.
How has the advent of Twitter and other social media changed that system?
Well, that's only really widened the field. So now we have journalists tweeting, we have politicians tweeting, but we also have lots of individual citizens who will tweet, who will post on other social media. And while they certainly don't have the same power with their megaphones, they certainly have the opportunity to get their ideas into the media discourse as well in ways that, you know, used to maybe be confined to the letter to the editor page. So we have a kind of wider and probably more cacophonous journalistic landscape than we used to as well.
But then does that cacophony drown out the initial message intended by the candidate and his or her team?
I mean, if you look how candidates, particularly in the last two or three decades, despite having all these media channels at their disposal, have often really struggled to get their message out because there are so many other voices out there and because citizens have so many choices, different news networks that can cater to their own individual politics. They have comedy networks that sort of dabble in politics. So it becomes much harder for a president. He can't simply say, I'm going to give a speech tonight from the Oval Office and expect that everybody's going to listen.
For the purposes of an inside history of the American presidency, where does the modern election cycle start?
I mean, I really started with 1896. So this is the year that William Jennings Bryan, as the Democrats' nominee, first goes stumping around the country. You know, people don't often realize in the 19th century, candidates stood for election. They didn't personally campaign on their own behalf. And then comes Theodore Roosevelt, who, as William McKinley's vice presidential nominee, does this for McKinley. So he goes traveling around giving speeches. And soon by the 20th century, this becomes the burden on presidential candidates to get out there, to shake hands, to give speeches in every town, and to show people that they're not above them, but they're one of them. And that's a real shift.
Recently, Reagan, of course, Clinton, and Obama come to mind as master campaigners connecting with people. Is it increasingly necessary moving forward, do you suspect, for candidates to have that skill?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think more than ever, and certainly in the last, 30 years or so, pretty much every candidate has been questioned on his or her authenticity, right? This has kind of become our new buzzword, which gets at the fact that authenticity, as we kind of imagine it, is really, in fact, kind of a contrived quality. That is to say, candidates can come across as down-to-earth, as funny, as spontaneous, but they're practicing that. To give just one little example from the book, in 1948, Harry Truman gave a speech at the Democratic Convention where he kind of ad-libbed it, and he got great reviews. This was Truman's new kind of improvisational style. People really liked the new Harry Truman. Turned out he'd been working on this for months in the radio studio with a coach because his previous speaking style had been seen as inadequate. Now, Harry Truman was a salt-of-the-earth kind of straight-talking guy, so it's not that it was phony, but it was practiced. And I think the same can be said for authenticity in today's candidates, that the ones who pull it off best have worked at it. They know the style that succeeds for them, and they've practiced and developed it, often with the help of speechwriters and consultants and all the same people who are being relied on by the candidates we think are too scripted and phony.
Professor, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Sure, my pleasure.
Rutgers University presidential historian David Greenberg, author of the new book entitled Republic of Spin, An Inside History of the American Presidency.